The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the program. It's Wednesday, so the good news is we're very, very close to Friday.
Yes.
We just have to make it to the weekend, and we are on our way. Bill O'Reilly is going to try to make sense of our world on Friday. You don't want to miss that. Bill is joining us now every Friday to talk a little bit about what he has observed and what the media and all the pundits have missed. That is on Friday. Today we have a full show for you. We have an update on everything that happened, and you want to talk about Fast and Furious. News is breaking on this so fast and so furious that many people are being left out of the facts. They don't even know what's happening. We're going to give you those facts. We're going to try to help you understand the world that we're living in right now. But more importantly, I want to start with trying to understand you. There's not enough people, there's nobody in the media that understands you. And I'm not sure that I have it. And I want to make sure that we are on the same page, that I have listened to you so I can better serve you and figure out the things that you're trying to understand. We begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
You know, one of the famous things that we're going to be remembered for at this time, because history will remember all of us and what we did and what we said. We are living truly in a pivot point of history. And yesterday, off the air, I looked at the team and I said, I can't believe we are living in these times. And we have a first row seat at the events of our day. This is an amazing time to be alive. But one of the things that people will talk about is climate chaos. I got up this morning and we're going on vacation next week. We're going up to the mountains and just getting away from it all. And my wife came into my closet and she's like, look. And she was holding up the weather forecast, and it's snowing in the mountains. And it was raining here this morning in Dallas. She's not happy. She's a sun worshiper. Climate chaos, raining in Dallas, snowing in the mountains, hot in Florida. Yeah, it's always like that. That's not chaos. You know what I know what chaos is? It's what we're living right now. We are truly living in a world of chaos. Watch the news. Try to make sense of it. Who do you trust? What institutions do you trust? What do you know is true? Really, truly true? Remember, I said to you years ago, and it seemed crazy to say it, everything you believe in will violate. Everything that you think is solid will be liquid, and everything liquid will be solid. The world will be upside down and inside out, and you won't recognize anything. Climate chaos? No, it's not the chaos caused by the climate. Here's the real chaos. You're causing the earth to die because of your SUV. And yet, we have to have those SUVs. We have to have General Motors. We have to have these things going. Let's bail them out to make sure that they can make more trucks, make more SUVs. While at the same time we're bailing them out, we're saying, the same people are saying, those trucks, those SUVs, they're evil. And oil is evil. Oil changed the world. Petroleum jelly. You don't have oil. You don't have petroleum. You don't have a sewing machine that works. You don't have a cotton gin that really works for very long. Chaos. Chaos comes from paying a tax on something that has now been deemed evil, but all of us went to school and learned that what we breathe out is what trees breathe in. Now is killing the planet, is killing the trees. How is that possible? Chaos. How many genders are there now? I know you're thinking right now. You're probably, if you're like most people, thinking two. Well, but there's, then there's, right? How many genders are there? Can a woman who is white identify as a black woman and work for the NAACP? No, of course not. Oh, wait, no, yes, it happened. And the left held her up. And yet, if you're white, you can't even talk about slavery because you can't relate to slavery. But somebody who is black, even if they were born and raised in the same town that you were born and raised in, went to the same school, in the general same class as you, they can understand it, but you can't. We can't use the same words. Chaos. There's no rule to anything. It's not consistent ever. It just depends on who's in charge and who's in power. 2 + 2 = 5. It's math. No, it doesn't. Yes, it does. If you can show me how you got there. That's mathematical chaos. We have to print more money to be able to make our dollar sound. What? We have to spend more money to get out of debt. What? $17 trillion isn't un-American, but a debt of $9 trillion certainly is. Which bathroom do I use? Which bathroom is she or he allowed to use? Is, and I'm sorry I said she or he. I don't know which one. Which are you identifying as, a man or a woman today? And if you're identifying as a woman, but you're a man, and I open up the door for you, am I going to be called a sexist? If you're obviously a very manly-looking man and you're wearing a dress, I'm going to notice you, but I'm going to be called a hater for even noticing that. Yet at the same time, we're taught, if you see something, say something. Even though our eyes, ears, and every statistic shows us, proves to us, those who follow an evil form of Islam kill or die while shouting, "Praise Allah," are simply practicing what God is telling them to do. And they're misunderstood. And you're the one who has all the hate, even though you're the one who will gladly live side by side with anybody who wants to believe anything, as long as they'll give us the same respect. Chaos. No rule applies consistently. Nobody can function in that. Agree or be silenced. Agree or be fired. Agree and promote or be shunned. Who are our heroes today? Every single hero has been mocked, ridiculed, and explained away. Our faith is mocked. Our media, who's supposed to stand guard for us against corruption, seem to stand guard against us, against our beliefs, our traditions, our institutions. In fact, while many of them came from us, they no longer even like us, or I think even honestly even understand us. Our money isn't safe in banks anymore. Wall Street is getting rich while your wage hasn't gone up, in some cases, since September 11th. Politicians are getting rich on the things that would put us in jail. Charlie Rangel entered Congress poor after serving in the army. He now has houses all over the world. He's wealthy. How? How did that happen? In the service of his country? And he's not alone. I don't mean to pick out, stick him out. They're all like that, or at least a lot of them. Better health care for them. Well, we can't keep our doctors. So what do? We first retreat to the things that we know that we can trust, our churches. When we get into our churches, we're surrounded by judgment and not people who actually care. People who are telling us they're better than us. Don't do these things, but they do them. Our doctors are prescribing drugs for our children for the things that make them children. And our adults are children, and they give us painkillers. We think it's okay because the doctor prescribed it, and try as we might, we can't get off those painkillers. In the end, the withdrawal and the symptoms of being on those painkillers are what's doing more damage. The withdrawal is worse than the pain in the end. And our doctors are now telling us that marijuana oil is the solution, a natural solution. But the government won't let us have a natural solution that doesn't get you high. We'd rather be on opioids. What's killing us? I got up this morning and it started with a weather forecast. And I thought, how do I explain the world to my audience? How do I tell you what's going on when I'm not even sure I know who you are? I started writing some notes on some of these things, and I don't know if this is the way you feel. This is the way I feel. We're living in a world of chaos. And it's important to point that out. Because when the rules don't apply equally, that's what's causing this tension. Our kids are in a sea of culture that I don't understand. There doesn't seem to be any morals, any boundaries. Suicide with millennials is up 30%. There's somewhere between 20 and 40 servicemen who come home and kill themselves every single day. The VA is failing them, putting them on more drugs. And those people in Washington who are in power are creating the same VA nightmare for us. The former Soviet Union is now led by a strong man, former KGB colonel. He came in as a poor KGB colonel. He's now one of the richest men in the world, and he looks like a good guy to a lot of people. Up is down, down is up, good is being made evil, evil is good, and it seems as though nobody gets it. You don't feel heard. You don't feel like anybody's really listening to you. I'll bet you many feel like nobody even sees me anymore. And if they do, they don't really care. They're just trying to make money off of me or trying to increase their power. Yeah, I've tried. Let's take our country back. I was called names, I wore myself out, and it didn't make any difference. Donald Trump got it. He knew that the real trouble was coming from this cultural chaos, even if he couldn't say it. The press, the universities, the schools that are indoctrinating our children that fingers are guns. He knew we needed the Supreme Court or we wouldn't stand a chance. He gave us that. You don't agree with everything he says, but at least he's swimming the other way. Now he's surrounded by people who have a career in D.C. The media has always hated him, and he's alone. We knew this would happen. Never let a guy like that be president. They'd never let that happen. Everything I thought I could trust has betrayed me, and now I'm alone, and he's alone, and I'm going down swinging. am I even close? I'd like to hear from you today. And with that framework, I'd like to tell you what happened yesterday and why it's not connecting with anybody in New York, Washington, Chicago, or LA. When we come back.
Glenn Beck. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Sign up for the newsletter and get all the info you need to know at glennbeck.com.
Okay, so here's why this isn't connecting. The media will never understand this, and we cannot commit the same crime. Who's lying? It's really hard to tell. You really just have to go with your gut, and it depends on which side. We're never going to make any inroads here because of the media. I blame the media for this. Now hear me out. There is no consistency. It's chaos. What does chaos come from? Chaos comes from the rule does not apply consistently, right? That's the American dream. The American dream has been accomplished because of patents, because of the rule of law, because justice was blind and it was applied whether you were rich, whether you were poor, good guy, bad guy, didn't matter. Everybody received the exact same treatment. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. So we're living in a world of chaos and we know that things are not equally applied. So let me just go through a couple of things. They're trying now to say that they have credibility on rule of law, foreign policy, truthfulness in the White House, even handling of classified information. The mainstream media is telling us that they have credibility on this, even though the mainstream media gave Barack Obama a free pass, carte blanche, to do or say whatever they wanted. The media's job is a check and a balance. So why did Hillary get a pass for literally the same things they're now slamming Trump on? In 2014, Greg Miller from the Washington Post, the same Greg Miller, was the same journalist that reported Trump's disclosure to the Russians. In 2014, ran a story on Obama exposing the name of a CIA agent in Afghanistan. Now, you could argue that that might be worse than what Trump did. But everybody ignored that. Can you imagine what the firestorm would be if he revealed an actual name of an agent in the line of fire? What would they say? Same reporter, same paper, completely different reaction. But why stop there? I've got miles of these examples, and we're going to go through a couple of them. And David Barton next.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
All right, it is Wednesday. We're almost to Friday. All we have to do is make it two more days. That's what President Trump should be saying to himself right now. I'm almost to Friday. If I just zip it right now, I can just coast to Friday. And then they'll leave me alone for the weekend. Welcome to the program. We started this hour, and if you didn't listen at the beginning, please go back to the podcast at glennbeck.com, or you can watch the show on theblaze.com/TV. But go back to the beginning, because I'm trying to figure out the ways to best serve you and help you. And first, we have to understand each other. I have to understand you, and you have to understand where I'm coming from. And where I'm coming from is this is a time of chaos, and what we're really feeling, and nobody's identifying it this way. They're identifying it as rule of law, or they're identifying it as political correctness. But rule of law isn't the same for everybody. Political correctness, what's politically incorrect for you to say, is perfectly fine for somebody else to say. Doesn't make any sense. That causes chaos and friction. And so what we need is consistency. But you can't find consistency without truth. And we're now being taught and told there is no universal truth. Well, I got news for you. There's no culture. There's nothing but chaos if we can't agree on truth. So one of the things that David Barton and I have been working on for a while is a museum, et cetera, et cetera. But that comes later. Gathering the documents and gathering these things to be able to put together the true story of America, and more importantly, the principles that allowed us to be free, was our first step. David is here, along with his son Tim, who is heading something new for Mercury One that is happening this summer. We have decided, because of the number of people who have applied and the scramble for it, that we have decided to expand it this summer. David, can you welcome, and can you guys explain exactly what we're doing this summer?
Yeah, we've had kind of a, I don't want to call it an intern program because that's the wrong concept, but it's a training program for young people 18 to 25 that are going into college, in college, or just out of college. And it really is
an apprentice program, apprentice program, because it's learning at the side of someone who knows history and then actually putting it into practice by their side so you can repeat it.
We know what they're going to get taught in colleges and schools. We know it's out there. We know what the profs say. Tim all the time is engaging profs in debates, and it's really fun to watch them have to back down on things. And so we know what they're going to get thrown at them, but the kids don't know how to respond to that. But with all the stuff we've collected over the years, they get to come in and actually handle that stuff. And we say, here's what's coming at you. And so when the prof says, you say, no, I held the document. I know that that's not true. And it does go back to, there is truth in history. Now, whether you like it or not, there's truth. And you can decide what you want to do with that. But kids right now aren't even being taught the basic truth. And that's what Tim does.
So Tim,
is really equip them.
First of all, how old are you? Like 25?
34.
Yeah. And they say black don't crack. What is your secret? 34 years old. Wow. Okay. You went to school to be a teacher, if I'm not mistaken.
I was a business major.
I'm sorry.
But I got very involved.
His microphone is not on, I don't think.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's safe for Jeffy to be in that part of.
No.
No, you should not have Jeffy.
If it's not on,
somebody. Just talking to Jeffy's chest here.
See, that's even better.
Hi.
It's a trick.
Doing, baby?
Okay, so you went as a business school, and went to business school.
Yeah.
Tell me about what changed you.
I actually got involved, very involved in my church. I got involved with ministry. I loved working with young people. So there was a local school. It feels weird just right
that's
here.
All right.
But okay,
Mike
just came on. Okay. You don't have to touch him anymore.
Thank you. That's the best part of this morning so far. Don't have to touch him anymore.
Wait.
Sorry. Anyway, go ahead.
But I love working with young people. And one of the things.
Now your mic is off. What the hell, guys? Right. Can we please figure this out? No, don't worry. A professional radio program.
Yes. I love working with young people. And so one of the things I enjoyed, I was a high school teacher and coach. But I had the opportunities throughout the summer, since I was off from teaching, to start traveling, doing things for Wall Builders. And I saw a big gap of knowledge with still a big desire of interest from young people who wanted to know how to answer problems.
Yeah.
How do we solve, as you mentioned in the monologue, you know, the whole chaos situation going on? Well, it really can.
Go ahead.
It really can be answered with a foundation of truth. And we just don't have a foundation of truth and culture to know how to answer these problems. As you were talking about, well, whether it's courage or integrity, there is a definition for courage and integrity. We don't know anymore. But because we've changed the definition of words, because there's not truth, college students are being taught mixed messages about even what truth is of history, But they want to know, what are the solutions to problems? What are the solutions to even history? And so that's one of the things we try to do, and that's really where I got involved in Wall Builders, is how do we help the next generation know what truth is?
So the real secret here, the amazing thing is there is truth. There are answers to these things, and they're not being taught in colleges. And I really believe you're right, that the young people that I meet, you know, the 20-somethings, when they hear this, their whole mind just turns on.
Yep.
And it's exciting. All of a sudden, they're like, wait a minute. And the whole thing starts to make sense. So what we've done is we've taken the Mercury One library and the Wall Builders library, which is extensive. How many documents together do you think we have? How many?
Well, we've got 120,000 from before 1812. And then Mercury One has another 8,000-10,000.
Okay. So we have this huge library of documents. And what we're doing is we're bringing in these apprentices, the people, they have to be 18 to 25 years old. And what we're doing is we're having you come in, work by the side of David, myself, and Tim this summer. And we're going to help you answer the questions of who these guys are. Is America a Christian nation? Is were we founded on Judeo-Christian principles? Were the founders Christians themselves? You know,
are they racist, bigots, slave owners?
Yeah, were they all rich white guys? Were they separation of church and state kind of guys? Or what did that really mean? When we say they're atheists, agnostics, and deists, well, who were the guys that were? Or even the thought of them being slave owners? Well, the founding fathers are also the ones that started the first abolition societies in America.
And what does the three-fifths clause
mean? Right.
Of this. And what we're doing is we're having you go back to the original source. And then you will be responsible for documenting, footnoting, and using the library and going to original sources only. Then we're going to put that work, after it's been checked and verified, we'll put that work online for others to be able to use along with those original documents. So not only will these apprentices be able to come in and learn everything and have hands-on experience with these unbelievable, you know, first copy of the documents, but they will also be able to help us propagate this all throughout the world.
Right. Yeah, with the first or original sources, these primary documents, it's something that certainly will diffuse a lot of the confusion that's being communicated at universities and give them a foundation to where when someone says something, they go, wait a second, no, I held the actual original document. I know what it said, and it's not what my professor tells me.
And it also answers the question, does it make any difference what they believed and what they said? Because that's the other thing. Does any of that stuff 200 years ago apply today?
Yeah,
we'll get into that.
Yeah, okay. So what are we asking for? Because I know we shut off applications because we filled up. How many spaces are you opening up?
Essentially about 15 for each session that we're opening up to bring in 15 more apprentices.
How many sessions?
There's two sessions. There's one in June. There's one in July. They can get the information on mercuryone.com, the website. They can sign. I think it's mercuryone.com/intern.
It's mercuryone.org, I believe, /
Interns.
There you go. No work.
Okay,
sure.
So this is not really an intern program. This is working side by side with Tim, with David. I will also be working, and we will show you. You will handle the original documents. Believe me, there is an extensive screening process to go through. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it'll be an application. We'll look through applications, and there's an actual face-to-face interview, which usually is through Skype or FaceTime or something. And then there's background checks. And because it's very limited, you know, we just can't take everybody. Now, we're going to start hopefully doing this over the summer, maybe even increase it in future summers. So if someone doesn't make it this summer, for sure, try to apply again next summer. But there is a lot of process going through, because if we can only take 15, it's going to be pretty elite whoever makes it.
Yeah, we'll have about 50 in each session this time. And so we were at about 35. We're going up to 50 with it.
Okay. And we hope to be able to eventually do this year round, not only just for kids, but also not this particular program, but younger kids and older kids.
Sure.
And quite honestly,
families
and adults. We hope to be able to provide the service eventually year round. This is the first time we're kicking it off this summer. And we would love to have you involved, but it is a rigorous screening process. I mean, you will be knee deep in millions of dollars worth of documents, original documents,
And so we just have to make sure we have the right people in who have the right attitude and right ethics and everything else. And so join us, mercuryone.org/intern. You can do that now. Guys, thank you very much. God bless. All right, our sponsor this half hour is My Patriot Supply. This weekend, North Korea had their 7th missile test. This one was successful, and it's a game changer. I don't know, because we're living in a world of chaos, I don't know what the red line is with this. Analysts have confirmed that the new North Korean missile can reach our Pacific military base. Vladimir Putin has now stepped in, and he has warned the United States and other leaders to stop intimidating North Korea. We are setting ourselves up for a global war, or we're being set up for a global war. We got to pray that that doesn't happen. You know, this New York Times thing came out over last weekend that said, if you can find North Korea on the map, you are more likely to say, negotiate, don't go to war. Now, that was the headline. But if you actually read the survey, Stu, there was something else kind of interesting that came out.
Yeah, seemingly the entire difference of...
Listen to this.
...between the two categories was Republican men versus Democratic men. So Republican men knew where North Korea was, Democratic men didn't. And that was the entire difference, basically, throughout the entire thing, which it was interesting that the Democrats wanted to either go to war or do nothing, where Republicans were the ones who were saying, actually, let's try everything we can other than go to war.
Right. And I think that's because Republican conservative men, we're motivated to find out what we believe because we're always thrown up against the wall as, you know, you don't know anything. Well, yes, actually, I do. And this survey showed that Republican men did know about it. But I think it's also a lot of those Republican men probably are former military and they know what the hell of war is. Mm-hmm. And they do not want to go to yet another war.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Boy, here's my advice to President Trump. You can maybe still save this if you are completely transparent and consistent. Comey has this record of being a guy who leaves a meeting and makes copious notes of what was said if he feels there's something wrong. And this is well known apparently in the FBI. This isn't going to be one memo. This is going to be many. And they are memos that weren't written long after. These were, I stepped out of the meeting and wrote everything that he could remember. That's very different than writing it later from memory. Whether they exist or not, we don't know.
Yeah, to that point. I mean, this is a New York Times report.
Yeah. Jason Chaffetz has said, turn them over. Yeah. And if not, he'll subpoena them. And he needs to right away. We need to get this out and over with.
But not only have we not seen the memo, the New York Times hasn't even seen the memo yet. It was read to them by a source who is favorable to Comey, obviously, wants Comey's side to get out there. So does the memo even exist? There seems to be a lot of evidence backing that up, but we haven't even seen it yet. So, I mean, the people that are jumping 25, you know, places past where we are, I don't think that's right, just like it wasn't right yesterday to exonerate him or impeach him. Like, we're not there. We need more information. This seems serious. Comey is a buttoned-up guy, so you think that there's a good chance that something like this
but
exists?
This isn't coming from this isn't coming from Comey. This is coming from a friend of Comey.
Who read it to someone else.
So, I mean, we have no idea if this is even true. If it is, it is real trouble for the president because he is apparently exerting his influence and trying to get the FBI to shut down the Flynn investigation. This is a nightmare. We need to get this stuff out, know what is true, deal with it, and move on. Jonah Goldberg next.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
program. Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
I have to tell you, I'm so excited about the next two people that we have to introduce you to today. This hour, we have Jonah Goldberg from National Review. He's a guy who, I don't know if he knows this or not, I think I've told him before, has really changed my life. He wrote a book called Liberal Fascism. Stuff I didn't even know. Nobody was taught. His dad was a real pioneer in this field and kept the torch alive. And Jonah has done such a great job to explain progressives and liberal fascism. And it opened my eyes to an entirely new world and changed the course of my life. I love having him on and reading his points of view. And he has a lot to say about what's happening. So we're going to get an update on what happened yesterday since we last met on in Washington with the Comey letter. And McMaster and his press conference. Also next hour, a serial entrepreneur. The guy who started Priceline, he has about 900 patents to his name. He was called by Forbes the Edison for a new age. He's the guy who came up with the friend button on Facebook. I can't wait to get into this guy's head as an entrepreneur. That's next hour. We begin this hour with Jonah Goldberg and what's happening in Washington. How do we make sense of it? Beginning right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the program, Jonah Goldberg. How are you, sir?
Glenn, great to be here, and thanks for the kind words up front. That was great.
Jonah, you're watching everything that is happening in Washington, D.C., and trying to make sense of it. The media does not have any credibility at all on trying to say rule of law, and gee, we can't have somebody handle classified material that doesn't know what they're doing with it. They have no credibility. It's a farce to watch them as they're talking about this when we know what they did with Obama and Hillary Clinton. However, if we want to be consistent, we're watching this and saying this does not look good. Can you take us through this, especially what happened yesterday?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, look, I mean, just as a big picture point, as I've been saying for a while, if hypocrisy were helium, we'd all have funny voices and some people would just float away. It is absolutely, as I keep saying to some of my friends on the right who are absolutely right in their criticisms of the double standards of the mainstream media and how the mainstream media is freaking out about stuff that it yawned about under Barack Obama. That's all a perfectly good point to make, and it's a good argument to make. But it's a necessary argument, but not a sufficient argument, in the sense that if the things that Obama did, and when Obama did X and the mainstream media didn't freak out, and you criticize the mainstream media for not freaking out, and then when Trump does X and you criticize the mainstream media for freaking out, well, you should be freaking out too, since you're, you know, if you believe in the rule of law and you think Obama violated the rule of law and you stomped your spoon on your high chair for 8 years about, you know, what Obama was doing to violate the rule of law, and then Trump violates the rule of law, and all you have to say is, look how hypocritical the New York Times is, well, then you're being a hypocrite, too. You have a double standard, too. You don't call out a Republican president for doing stuff that you condemned a Democratic president for. Fine, call the New York Times a bunch of hypocrites, but you're being hypocritical, too. And this is a huge problem on the right. with a lot of people sort of trying to find this safe harbor of anti-Trumpism. They don't, and they're absolutely right that, you know, much of the left-wing freakout, this resistance nonsense and all that, is absurd. I mean, so much of it has been, you know, Donald Trump put salt on his French fries. Hitler put salt on his French fries. You know, it's that kind of nonsense. And I'm all in favor of calling it out. But if that's all you're doing a disservice. Because some of the things that Donald Trump has done are legitimately worth criticizing. Which brings us to yesterday. So we all remember that I mean, it's amazing to, you know, it's just barely a week. Barely over a week since Sally Yates testified. The space-time continuum has been sort of accordioned in Washington, and it's this bizarre thing where each day sort of brings, usually right around my cocktail hour, which really ticks me off, brings some new story. Well, yes, there is that. Look, I have a tattoo that says if you don't start drinking in the morning, you can't claim that you were drinking all day. So the White House, you know, announced that they fired Comey last week. Turned out that the story that they brought out there was just flatly not believable and turned out to be untrue within a couple of days. Donald Trump told Lester Holt that he fired him because of the Russia investigation, which... from any other president would have everyone pulling their hair out because you're just not supposed to say that, you know, you're not supposed to say that you didn't like an investigation into your campaign or into you or whatever. And you called it off you fired the FBI director because he didn't make it go away. And so this sort of gets us to the core problem is that Donald Trump's greatest defense is incompetence and ignorance. He doesn't know how the system works. He doesn't have an appreciation that some rules and procedures that are traditional in a White House are there for a good reason. I don't know if you guys remember, you know, the parable of Chesterton's fence. G.K. Chesterton has this wonderful story where he says, and he's talking about progressive reformers, and he says the progressive reformer is the kind of guy who sees a fence in the middle of a field, has no idea why it's there, and says, let's tear it down because there's no good reason for it to be there. I can't imagine why it's there. And Chesterton says the only time you have a reason to tear down the fence is once you understand why it was put up in the first place. Maybe it's keeping out the ice zombies and the White Walkers. Who knows? And Donald Trump has contempt for all of the traditional rules, all the traditional procedures, and he wants to go off the cuff. And so when he does stuff like ask the FBI director, as we learned yesterday, to go easy on an investigation into Mike Flynn, the former national security advisor, it seems utterly plausible that, you know, he can just be like, oh, was I not supposed to do that? You know, because he doesn't know, you know, he doesn't know what he doesn't know.
But the
problem for the left is they all want to make it about Russia collusion. You know, they want to go to 11 on all this stuff and they want to have it both ways. They did this with George W. Bush, too. They want to say he's an idiot and they want to say he is a genius mastermind of an international conspiracy.
Yeah.
You can't have it both ways.
So I don't think that he's a genius mastermind of a conspiracy. I think you're right. He has contempt for rules. He doesn't want to live by those rules. And in fact, one of the sources that we talked to Eric Erickson about yesterday, he said, you know, look, the guy is a huge Trump supporter, supported him all the way through the campaign. Eric said, I couldn't even talk to him during the campaign because he was so rabidly Trump. But he was one of the sources that has leaked this information about what really happened. And he said he's doing it because the president will not listen to any advice. He sees all advice as an attack on him. So he is isolated. And he's saying we have to leak it to the press because we're hoping that he'll listen to the press more than he's and have him driven back into our arms saying, okay, what do I have to know about this? He said he's just out of control and really bad things will happen if he doesn't start taking some common sense advice on, no, Mr. President, we can't do that because of X, Y, and Z. Now, we can find another way to do it, but we can't do that.
I agree with that. I wrote a column for the LA Times yesterday. It's up at National Review today. Calling on Michael Pence. You know, Mike Pence is the one guy, the one constitutional officer in the executive branch that Donald Trump can't fire. And so he, you know, all these other guys in the cabinet, some of whom I like and respect a lot, all these people in senior staff, some of whom I like and respect, they can all be fired. And they all seem to think that they have to audition every day for their job. Mike Pence doesn't. And Mike Pence was humiliated by the president last week, and not for the first time, by going out and saying, that, oh, no, we fired Comey on the recommendation of the deputy attorney general, and it was all through proper procedure, and we had waited for the DAG to get there, and they said, of course, this has nothing to do with the Russian investigation. And then 2 days later, Donald Trump uses a catapult to throw him under a bus. And Mike Pence should march into the Oval Office and say, Mr. President, if you do that again, I may have to resign and run against you in 2020, or I am going to start speaking freely to the media on the record. You know, he can't be fired, and he would have an enormous bully pulpit.
Okay, wait, but, hang on just a second. That was my advice for Hillary Clinton when Bill Clinton did this to her with the blue dress. She should have marched out and said, he's still my president. I still agree with his policies. But no woman should be treated this way. And what we work out in our marriage is our business. Stay out of our marriage. But no woman should be treated that way. She would have been the most powerful woman in the world. She, however, decided to stay in, I think, for her own power and everything else. And that was kind of the arrangement that they had. With Pence, I wonder if Pence and McMasters, who I have great respect for, although I saw him tap dance like nobody else yesterday. It was an amazing answer from him yesterday. And I'm wondering if these guys are saying to themselves, look, if I leave, I don't know who he's going to have for advice. And I'd rather be in here and I'll take the hits for this. But we have got to get him on track and keep him in place. And who's going to replace me? It could be anyone.
No, look, I agree with that. I have to assume that H.R. McMaster, to the extent that he kind of, as you put it, tap danced and parsed over the last 48 hours, he was doing it either to protect national security by minimizing the damage of this story, or because he thinks that if I'm not in there, we're going to go back to someone like Mike Flynn or worse, and I am, you know, I need to keep, you know, things operating in as professional a manner as possible. I have to think it was patriotism,
I think so too,
in some way or another.
He's an amazingly credible man, and he knows, I mean, what he said yesterday was anything the president wants to do is appropriate. Legally, it's appropriate. Then they asked, so did he do anything inappropriate? No. Well, he just said anything he wants to do is appropriate. And he knows that, you know, to come out with Jerusalem as the city and the Israelis, that is wildly damaging to our spy apparatus. Yeah. Wildly damaging.
I still think there's a possibility that Israel has taken one for the team and that it was actually Jordan. You know, it's not like Israel is going to break its relationship with us over this. They understand. And they've got all the stuff coming up on this visit that's of bigger importance. But if Jordan had been revealed as the source, it could really cause them. But I don't know. Who knows? But look, I wrote this the other day. I keep thinking that poor Reince Priebus and Mike Pence and these other guys who I honestly think their hearts are in the right place, I imagine all of them like Jerry Maguire in the locker room begging Cuba Gooding Jr., help me, help you. You know, I mean, it's like if Trump could just get a little discipline, you know, I mean, and get a little sort of a little less addicted, a little weaned off of the drama and the reality show vibe that he clearly thrives on, he could still get important things accomplished. But it's like you can't break through to him. And this thing about, you know, back-channeling to him through the media, that's been going on since day one. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I actually like liked watching Morning Joe so much for the first couple months of the administration is it because it's like reading Pravda. You know, you just never know who's like signaling from what point of the Politburo through the press to the first among equals. And and I think that's a real problem. If he's consuming and getting all his advice filtered through what he sees on Fox and Friends or printed out from Breitbart.com, that is no way to run a country.
Okay, I only have 1 minute. One more question.
Politically, Jonah, isn't it the issue here that his surrogates, their most effective defense is to basically say he's incompetent, he's new, he's trying to figure this stuff out. But that's also simultaneously the one thing that they absolutely, under any circumstances, cannot say.
No, that's right. And that's why, and I wrote about this months ago, they fall back on this, he's a man of action, he's a man of wisdom, he knows things that we don't know. And the problem with that kind of rhetoric is that it may work for a moment politically, although its credibility is diminishing, but that's also cult of personality talk. You know, that is not how conservatives, that's not how people in a democracy are supposed to talk, is just say, well, he's the president and he has the supreme judgment and who are we to question it? The whole point of democracy is to question the judgment of your political leaders, but that's where the surrogates have to go, and I don't think it works for them very much at all anymore, and it doesn't help fend off anybody who isn't sort of already in the tank.
Jonah, what 30 seconds. Can you tell me what we should watch for? What's the a good sign or a bad sign that we should watch for?
Well, if the rivers turn to blood, okay. I don't want to offend any of your advertisers, but buy gold.
Okay. All right. Jonah, God bless you, man. Thank you very much. Jonah Goldberg.
Good to be here, guys. Thank you.
Senior editor of National Review.
Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BACK.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Yesterday, the media found a new word.
Mr. Woolsey told several people contemporaneous, and I've spoken with them, and they've...
There are contemporaneous notes that would back up. There was other contemporaneous notes.
We're just talking about contemporaneous issues.
If the FBI is still doing one, contemporaneous with anything they're doing, but I don't think we can afford...
I'd have a discussion contemporaneous.
They're going to have a hard time proving it because they didn't catch him contemporaneous.
That having these type of contemporaneous memos...
And we have Director Comey's contemporaneous notes. They're called 302s. They are contemporaneous memos.
Bob Mueller kept his contemporaneous notes.
Contemporaneous notes of those conversations.
What do Comey's contemporaneous memos say?
Which is a nod, again, to how powerful a contemporaneous...
Those notes, the contemporaneous notes.
So we're contemporaneous at the time.
One reason why lawyers take contemporary notes is...
Rely on a contemporaneous...
As close to a contemporaneous way.
Where he has... made contemporaneous memos.
How contemporaneous is...
We're contemporaneous at the time.
The FBI director kept contemporaneous, sorry. God, it's hard to say that word. Contemporaneous.
Especially when I've never seen it before.
Yeah. But that one made me feel better.
Yeah,
made me feel better. So they found this new word yesterday, and they found it for a very important reason. And we need to start with the definition of contemporaneous and why they're using that word, helping you understand your world a little bit more when we come back.
Mr. Woolsey told several people contemporaneous, and I've spoken with them, and they've...
There are contemporaneous notes that would back up. There was other contemporaneous notes.
We're just talking about contemporaneous issues.
if the FBI is still doing one, contemporaneous with anything they're doing, but I don't think we can afford...
I'd have a discussion contemporaneous.
They're going to have a hard time proving it because they didn't catch him contemporaneous.
That having these type of contemporaneous memos...
And we have Director Comey's contemporaneous notes. They're called 302s. 02s. They are contemporaneous memos.
Bob Mueller kept his contemporaneous notes.
Contemporaneous notes of those conversations.
What do Comey's contemporaneous memos say?
Which is a nod, again, to how powerful contemporaneous...
Those notes, the contemporaneous notes.
So we're contemporaneous at the time.
One reason why lawyers take contemporary notes is...
Rely on a contemporaneous...
As close to a contemporaneous way.
Where he has made contemporaneous memos.
How contemporaneous is...
We're contemporaneous at the time.
The FBI director kept contemporaneous, sorry. God, it's hard to say that word. Contemporaneous.
It is.
Well, you've never seen it. You don't know what it means.
All right. So Merriam-Webster defines contemporaneous, existing, occurring, or beginning during the same time. So a political event and cultural event that are happening at the same time. In this particular case, the notes that are contemporary, because the notes were taken at the same time as the meeting. So there's difference between notes that you go and you write, you know, a week or two later, as opposed to the notes that you take at the time. Now, when I met with President Bush, I know that I could not take a pencil and paper, a telephone, anything in, no recording device. However, I could record my reflections of feelings. That's what it was explained to me. And so I know that when you're with the president, if he's having an off-the-record talk with you, the rules are you don't write anything down. And so the minute you try to remember everything, I mean, it's the most important meeting of your life. You try to remember everything that is being said to you. And then the minute you get out of that meeting, I mean, I remember, were you, I don't remember who was with me, Stu, I don't think you were with me.
No.
But I had somebody standing right outside of the gates of the White House with a pad and a pencil and a phone. And I, you know, vomited into the phone as much as I could, blah, 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 as much as I could remember. And then I started writing it all down so I could remember. That's what James Comey did. He left the meeting and he immediately wrote down what happened in the meeting. Now, this is not something that James Comey just did for this meeting. He is known in the FBI as being very, very buttoned up.
Also very, very contemporaneous.
Yeah,
really
very,
contemporaneous.
Very contemporaneous.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See, that comment is happening contemporaneously with this subject.
It is.
Very good. Thank you for the exhibition.
I was speaking contemporaneously.
Yes, you were. Yes. And you were exhibiting your contemporaneousness, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And I will.
Okay.
And I will.
So what he did is, whenever he was involved in a serious exchange or case or anything like that, he is known as taking copious contemporaneous notes. I'm going to let you figure out copious yourself if you don't know. But he would take copious notes as soon as he would leave meetings, and then he would file them away. So we don't know if these notes are real, but it is definitely a shot back to the White House saying, oh, really, you got tapes? Good, because I've got contemporaneous notes. And so whichever one's playing chicken here is making the other one sweat.
Yeah, and they keep pointing that out specifically because, like, think about the alternate situation here. James Comey comes to testify after he's been fired and says, well, you know what? Trump told me in that meeting that he wanted me to back off the Flynn thing. I don't think he should have done that. I felt uncomfortable. Well, that means nothing after he's been fired, right? I mean, if he's saying that now, everyone's going to say, well, look, he's just saying that now because...
But if he supposedly wrote that down at the time...
And it was filed at the time, so it's not even supposedly. It was known. It was filed in a way that it was marked and it was known that that was the time it was filed. It's going to be a lot more powerful and credible. While he was still working for them, while they were still, where they were having meetings before and after this, supposedly he did this with every personal meeting he had with Trump. And the details
Don't
of that
you
meeting...
you also record it if you're going to do that?
No,
to have
you
proof?
Can't. You can't.
Probably can't record
no, you can't.
Your conversations
you're
with
asked,
the president.
No, you're asked.
Well, and his answer...
You better hope there's no tapes.
Yeah, well, and their response to that comment from Trump was, oh, I hope there are. You know, his side is saying, yes, please bring on the tapes. If they exist, please bring them on. And the rumor is, at least the speculation, is that this was leaked to the media so that the Congress would subpoena these things.
Well, Jason Chaffetz has already said, turn them over or I will subpoena them.
Yep.
And they should be subpoenaed. The White House record should be subpoenaed. We should know all of these things, and we should be as transparent, and the media should shut their pie hole and let the system work. There's a clear way to make this work. There was a clear way to make the IRS investigation work, but we didn't follow it. And what happened?
Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's follow the rule of law. And, you know, what is it? 70% of the American people now say appoint a special prosecutor. Look, I want a neutral special prosecutor. I don't want a guy who is hell-bent on destroying the president or anything else. I want somebody who is just going to look at the facts of this, and they don't have a horse in this race. Please, for the good of the nation, we need to know, is the president a liar? Is the president reckless with classified information? If those things are true, we need to know it. And I mean, when I say a liar, we know that, I mean, we've seen this record. But when it comes down to the United States of America, are you lying to us, dude? I mean, this is not about, you know, this is not about your personal life or anything else. This isn't even about you. And that's what's so sad about this is I think the president keeps thinking all of this is about him. And I do believe with the press, it is about him.
Yeah, they don't care. Many of them, at least, don't care about what the truth here.
Right.
Many of them. But again, Jonah Goldberg brought this up and I think said it correctly, is that yes, of course they want to take him down. There's no disagreement. You talked about this with Bill O'Reilly last week, too. He's like, but Beck, I can't believe you don't get what they want to take you out. Well, of course you get that. You absolutely get that the media wants to take Trump out at all costs and will do whatever they have to do that.
Yeah. However,
if there is something legitimately to be criticized, you have to have the principles and spine to do it.
Now, you're speaking uraneously, right?
Uraneously, yes.
That's
or
right.
Contemporarily.
Contemporaneously.
Uraneously means you're speaking out of your butt.
Oh, yes, uraneously. That's a good point.
You're speaking uraneously. You're speaking out of your butt. And that happens a lot on this program.
It absolutely does.
Now, that's the Webster's dictionary definition.
That's
of it,
Miriam.
Right?
Yeah, Miriam okay. Webster. Right. Not Miriam. That's Miriam, the wife of, I don't know, Bill Webster or whatever. Miriam, she's got her own
sure.
dictionary.
These are
the
all facts.
Family had dictionaries.
The whole family had
it's really kind of weird.
There was Bill and the other Webster, famous one, and then Miriam.
Right.
Who was a sweetheart of a gal.
And we should point out, and we have several times today, again, think of the chain that this has come down here. This is a Comey ally who didn't give the memo to the New York Times, who read over the phone a memo to the New York Times. The New York Times took notes over what he read. Did they read the entire thing? Did they read only the parts that they liked? Were there other parts of the memo that made Trump look really good? We don't know any of that. That information went to the New York Times reporter. Do we blindly believe everything the New York Times says? Absolutely not. Did the New York Times print the entire memo? No. We haven't seen it yet. The reporter hasn't even seen it yet. Nobody outside of the FBI has actually seen this thing yet. The other side of it is, this is not going to be the only memo. I think it's, you know, if it does exist, which you can't believe they just, you know, but it's possible, right? It's a Comey ally. It's not impossible that they just made it up. We saw that with the Rather situation, mm-hmm. that someone who was going up against George W. Bush literally mm-hmm. made something up. It's mm-hmm. not impossible. But if it does exist, it's not going to be the only one. Comey was well known for this practice. He was well known for creating paper trails when he believed something was going wrong, when he was made uncomfortable. He was a guy who documented what happened his interactions with this president.
It is not the way we meant it, but it is turning out to be the same thing. Don't screw with the justice and intelligence agencies. Don't piss them off. They will find out what you're doing and they will destroy you with it.
And again, like this goes back to a very pro Donald Trump point. Pro Donald Trump. You need to do these things better. Do it better. If Donald Trump would, firing James Comey, There was a lot of arguments that were legitimate to do it. I tend to like the guy a little bit, and I, you know, I'm more probably pro James Comey than a lot of the audience. But the bottom line is, you could fire him, but the way they did it, the time they did it, the manner that they did it, the fact that he trashed him after he walked out of the office, the fact that he's been trashing intelligence this entire time, puts you in a position where you can't get any of, you can't build walls in this environment. You can't get any of the things you want done.
If I were talking to President Trump today as a supporter of his, I would sit him down and say, Mr. President, there's a couple of things you have to do. First of all, you have to stop taking everything personally. Okay? You have to. And I know you like to read the press and everything else, but you are getting caught in this cycle, and it's not healthy for you. It's not healthy for you, and it's not healthy for the country, and you're not going to win it. So, because there is no winning. This is mutually assured destruction. We all are destroyed by this kind of cycle. Stop. Two, you just need to know that appearances are important as the president. And you're right. You could fire James Comey. And you can make the case to me that you should have. You don't trust him. He's your guy. He's the guy in charge of justice. And we have two letters, and assuming that those are, you know, legitimate and not coerced, there are two letters here from the people who are running justice that say they don't think that he is good for the FBI. Great. But don't humiliate people on the way out. Don't be above all of this. Just be above all of this.
I don't think he has anybody around him that will speak to him like that.
I don't think, I think we learned yesterday that he has people who try to speak to him like that, but he won't listen.
But they do it now through the media.
It would have been better if he would have fired Comey day one. If he would have come in and that was the first step he took, was to fire James Comey. I don't think there'd be this.
But what's happening is, what these contemporaneous notes supposedly show is that he wouldn't listen to Flynn is in trouble, Flynn's trouble, Flynn's trouble, Flynn's trouble. Then finally broke through to him. Flynn is trouble. That's when he met with Comey and said, look, he's a good guy. You know, let's just forget this. I hope you can forget all this and you just forget it. Well, that is obstruction of justice, because he's your boss. It's not just some guy. It's the president of the United States trying to say, stop investigating one guy. And, you know, I am assuming that I have your loyalty. And, you know, I hope you can let this go. That's not good. Whether that is what he intended or not, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because it's
that goes to the appearance of it as president.
Yes.
It doesn't look good.
And he needs to listen to people just on appearances. Uh-huh. Just listen to people on appearances.
His best defense, too, on this stuff. And I think it makes sense, is that he doesn't know. Right. He's coming out and he's saying, look, man,
well,
I love this guy.
The excuse the whole time.
They made me fire Flynn. I hope you don't bust on him because he's a good guy. To Donald Trump, that may be a very normal way to go. The problem is, none of his surrogates can admit he's not perfect, because they will get fired. None of them can say his best defense.
Right.
And that's a real problem.
And the problem is, that's going to wear thin after a while. There's no learning curve.
No. Mm-hmm.
He's got to have a learning curve and show humility and say, boy, guys, I've really screwed this up. And I'm sorry. This is one of the things about me. I'm not a politician, so I don't know these rules. But I will tell you, I just talked to this guy. I have him by my side. I think he has good advice. He's a guy that everybody really trusts. I'm going to try to make a difference. He needs to start going in that direction.
You're asking for sorcery, and it's not going to happen.
I am trying to help the president remain the president of the United States.
Yes.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
I don't know about you guys. I am so excited to have Jay Walker on next. He is an inventor. He is a guy known as a serial entrepreneur. He started Priceline.com. He has 900 different patents. He's the guy who said, why don't we put a friend button on Facebook? I mean, this guy, and he sees the world. I've talked to him off the air. He sees the world in a completely different way. He's just started his imagination, human history of the History of the Human Imagination Museum. We're going to talk to him next.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. There's a lot going on in the world today. We've covered it for the last 2 hours. If you want some in-depth analysis of what the Comey letter means and what Trump is doing and what Congress is doing, go to the website, glennbeck.com. We've covered that. We're going to hit some of the highlights this hour as well. But I have to tell you this, if you are an entrepreneur, if you are a dreamer and a doer, this is going to be a fantastic hour. I have wanted to sit down with this guy for quite some time, a guy known as a serial entrepreneur, a guy that Forbes magazine said, an Edison for a new age, has 900 patents to his name. You know his work through Priceline.com or the little friend button on Facebook, his idea. A historian, a dreamer, an entrepreneur, a man who sees the future in a positive way. Jay Walker begins right now.
Of entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I first talked to Jay Walker. I've known about him for a long, long time, but I first met Jay Walker on the phone. This is the first time we've actually sat in the same room together. And immediately, I felt connected to him and the way he thinks. He's an optimist. He sees a massive change on the horizon, but he knows it doesn't have to be bad. It probably is going to be a little rough getting there, but it doesn't have to be bad. And he sees the future unlike most people do. And he sees it through the eyes of history, which is so wickedly important. Just full disclosure, he is the guy who started Upside.com, which is an advertiser on this program. But I do want to ask him one question of something that he told me about Upside when we first spoke. But this is not an advertisement. We're not even going to talk about that. You need to meet this man. He's just started something called TEDMD, which is TED Talks. I'm not sorry, MedTed. Sorry, MedTed. Yeah, TED Med.
TED Med.
Jeez, how many times am I going to get this wrong?
You only asked him three times before he came on.
I know. Jeez, what am I thinking? He started this, and I want to start here. And I hate to bring it to a cheesy TV show, but I've been watching a show, and now I can't even remember the name of it. It is Genius. Pure Genius.
Which was just canceled.
Was it canceled?
Yes, but was it really canceled?
Crap, that was such an optimistic show.
I know.
Have you seen that, Jim?
I have not.
Okay, so the premise is a guy who's a billionaire, kind of, you know, a guy like you, just a serial entrepreneur, tech guy. He's in Silicon Valley. He's like, I'm going to start a hospital. And it shows.
Oh boy,
I know.
He'd be better off starting a government.
I know. So, but it shows all the. It takes all the red tape out, and it shows all the tech that is coming, and how optimistic life really looks when you look at what's on the horizon and the breakthroughs we're about to go through. As you're doing this, what are you seeing for?
Well, Glenn, the way to think about it in health and medicine is that for 3 billion years, life on the planet has followed a very simple system. It's very simple. There's one, you know, there's DNA, we have a common ancestor, and it's been evolving for 3 billion years, give or take, depending on your beliefs, and I'm not picking on anybody's beliefs. But the fact is, we all share the same DNA, a tree, a dog, a human. We have so much in common. For the first time in human history, in the history of the world, humans have control of the operating code. We are now manipulating the DNA, which means for the first time, it's as if we had the software of life. That's never happened in history before. It means for the first time, we're going to be able to operate down at the instruction layer, which creates the proteins, which then creates the tissues and the systems and the organs of the body. So we're right at the cusp. It's almost as if we were inventing printing, reading, writing, and thinking all at the same time in forms of medicine. And so we are living at the beginning of an extraordinary time in the history of the world.
We're at the end of the medical dark ages.
Exactly. It's as if we had just gotten the microscope for the first time, and we saw there was a tiny world that nobody knew existed. In 1665, Hooke looks through his microscope, and he sees that the fly is composed of thousands of little eyes. And he says, what is this micro world? What are these little things swimming around? And he can't even see bacteria. He can't even see the smallest things. And yet, an entirely new world opens up. Galileo looks into the heavens and sees that there are planets, but also sees that there are moons around Saturn and Jupiter. And suddenly, the notion that the Earth is in the center of the universe drops away. The telescope and the microscope were the great changes of the 17th century, and now we're in the 21st century, and we're now seeing for the first time the actual code that brings things to life.
We're seeing things. Ray Kurzweil, I've talked to several times.
Ray talks about we're about to hit this point at which everything breaks free and goes on an extraordinary compounding effect. And whether or not you agree or disagree with Ray, there is no question, if you back up and look at where we are in history, in medicine and health, we are about to exit the dark age.
So he said the human body should last a lot longer than it does. It shouldn't wear out. He said it's as if there's a switch somewhere that's just been turned off. And he said, we just have to find that switch. Are you, when you look at the DNA...
Yeah, I would agree with Ray on that, but I understand where he's coming from. The human body isn't a thing. The human body is a system. Think of the Amazon rainforest. It's composed of enormous different things. It's got trees, insects, it's got birds, it's got animals, it's got leaves, it's got photosynthesis, it's got fungi. It's got all these things, and we call it the Amazon. It's constantly changing. You are an Amazon rainforest. You have trillions of cells
I think that's a fat joke.
So we have to switch on or off the Amazon rainforest. Now, the Amazon rainforest isn't going away despite, you know, our efforts to cut it down for lumber or for grow grass. But that being said, it's about a system. What we're learning is how all the different systems of the body, including many that are not even human, we're learning about the microbiome. These are bacteria that we need to survive in our guts and all throughout us, for which without them, we can't make it.
How far do you think we are away from curing the majority of cancer?
I think we're far from curing the majority, but we're not far from turning a significant number of cancers into a manageable, livable disease, like we did with AIDS. We figured out not how to cure AIDS, but how to slow it down so you could live with the rest of your life with it. Much like all men have prostate cancer, we just don't die of it. But literally 100% of men, if you do an autopsy at age 75, are going to have prostate cancer. They're simply not going to die from it. Cancer is essentially a natural byproduct of having multicellular organisms. Because in the process of duplicating at the cellular level, you're going to have some mistakes randomly, and some of those mistakes are going to be so damn good at not being killed that they're going to reproduce in a way that's bad for the organism as a whole, but good for the cell. So we don't eliminate cancer. We eventually figure out how to manage with it.
How far do you think we are from that?
If you say 50%, if you're saying leukemias and blood cancers, we're probably 5 years, maybe 10. If
Holy
you're saying
cow.
Solid, if you're saying soft tissue cancers, more like 10 to 20. But a lot of it depends on whether or not we get better at finding them sooner. Today, we cannot detect cancer until it's about 7 years old. So when somebody comes from a doctor and they said, I've been diagnosed with cancer, you've had it for 7 years. We can't see less than 100 million cells, which is less than the tiny point of a pin, 100 million cancer cells. So cancer is a system disease of which we have many in our bodies, most of which will never come to the point where they hurt us. Cancer isn't like an infection where it's binary. You have it or you don't. Cancer is a symptom of the system, and the system learns to cope with it for most of your life.
What's the most amazing thing you see on the horizon in medical tech?
The most amazing thing is probably the mapping of the human proteome. So we call all the proteins are the workhorses of the body. They're the things that do all the work in your body. Your DNA codes for proteins. Proteins are the worker bees of the body at the simplest level. We really have never mapped them all. And it turns out most of the diseases, if not nearly all of them, are dysfunctions of protein operations. Proteins are very complicated organisms. They're very, very small, but they're very complicated. We are now at the cusp of mapping them all. And forget about mapping the human genome, which is great. It's the proteome where all the action is at. And we're right about to map it.
What will that change?
Well, it'll allow us for the first time to understand what's really going on with disease. Up to now, we've actually not understood what's really going on.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that the proteins are malfunctioning.
Hang on
just
a second.
Disease.
I just wanna, you know you're in the room with somebody who is smart when you're, I now am three levels deep of asking, what the hell does that mean? And I'm really going back to the same question.
Keep it broad for the
no,
audience.
I know, I know.
I'm just, not an MD or a PhD.
No,
it's
amazing.
I'm really not a doctor.
Yeah.
Okay, I just talk to them all day.
Right.
And by the way, that's my spare time job because my main job is building a great company in Upside. So ironically, we're off on the side here. But the basically what it means is when we learn how proteins behave badly, we will recognize that your arthritis may be very similar to the fact that you have a sleep apnea, that there are the same proteins just misbehaving. There is a map of all the proteins. And once we start to look at where the proteins are behaving badly, we now have the tools to finally figure out what the hell is going on with these diseases. We don't know anything about Alzheimer's.
So much
of that is a protein
misbehaving. So that's why sometimes you'll go in and things are absolutely not connected. Doctors will tell you it's not connected.
Yeah.
Well, but they're all happening at the same time.
Right.
And yeah, I know they're not connected, but I never had these before, and now they're all happening.
Everything is connected.
Yeah.
Okay, so anybody who tells you something isn't connected, you don't go into the Amazon rainforest and say, well, the fact that the toads are dying is unconnected to the blight on the trees. No, everything is connected. The question is, at what level?
Right.
Does it have a common cause, or is it the result of common external factors? We're learning all that.
You know what I'm amazed? Talking to people like you, I feel really... average. That's being very kind.
This isn't your area of expertise.
No,
in all
I
fairness.
Know I know that. But still, this is not your job.
It's not my day job.
And the people that I meet, like you, have they always been around? Because I look through history, and you'll see the people like Tesla and Edison. You'll see these people who are really quite bright in a million different things. We used to call them Renaissance men.
Yeah.
But there is something about this new group of entrepreneurs that they are... John Huntsman Sr. is a friend of mine and started the Huntsman Cancer Center.
Yeah.
And he said to me, I asked him, teach me how to be charitable. I've been poor my whole life. I don't know how to be charitable.
It's an art. You have to learn how to do it. Yeah.
Yes. And he said, first lesson, you have to care about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Not just can't. You have to care about everything. And that kind of goes to...
It's very American. So this is a nation of insatiable curiosity. It's always been that way. It's because we've had the West. We were founded by a group of people who were fleeing somewhere else, with the handful of exceptions of the people who were here, right? We all come from somewhere else. We've all left a world behind in order to come and build a new world in America. Nobody even knew it existed until 1500. So the beauty of the American spirit is it's a spirit of insatiable curiosity. That's why we're a nation of tinkerers, a nation of inventors, a nation that's always trying to change. We don't look back as a nation. It's a weakness and a strength both at the same time. But the fact is, this is the country, and America looks forward. People like that are insatiably curious about everything. And you find whether it's John Muir or Thomas Edison, these people recognize that at the deepest level, it's all connected. So I have a great library in the history of human imagination, about 25,000 books.
Love this.
Right now, it's a library about imagination. And people come to my library and they say, how are the books organized, Jay? How do you organize the books? You have 25,000 books. Is there a card catalog? I say, absolutely not. They're organized randomly by height. And he goes, you have a library of 25,000 books organized randomly? I said, yes. It's about imagination. You connect them. They were all written by humans. They're all connected. You figure out why this is connected to that. The act of imagining is the essential act of creation. Nothing happens if you don't imagine it, whether it's who you're going to marry, the children you want to have, the kind of country you want to live in, the kind of job you want to have. It's all about your imagination. Everything happens here first. It happens in your head.
We're having a great debate right now between the legal and business side and the creative side of this company of what who's a creative. And I keep saying everyone is.
We all work for the customer. We all work for the customer.
But it's not even that. It's I am fill in the blank. I am happy or I am sad. What are you going to create at the basic level?
Yeah.
And everyone has the same power in a different way. Just what are you creating?
Yeah, and we've taught, unfortunately, in so many ways, we live in a society of specialists. We've taught specialize, focus on one field, do the best. Your economic result will be highest if you specialize. And that's true. But it's generalists who integrate completely unexpectedly. When you look at Steve Jobs and his life, you see a generalist, not a specialist. You see a guy who was happy to go to India, happy to learn about type fonts, happy to understand the aesthetics of design, and yet he was a technologist. Why? Because really great leaps forward are made by people who integrate from multiple fields. And that's why we call them polymaths when they happen to be geniuses. Leonardo was a polymath. He was a genius in five fields. That allowed him to be a bigger genius than any one of them. And we see this throughout history.
We are going to run out of time so fast. Jay Walker, a serial entrepreneur, founder, co-founder of Priceline, and many other things, 900 patents. We'll continue our conversation with him in just a second.
Glenn Beck. Want to see Glenn live? If you're coming to Texas, you can. Join us at Mercury Studios in Dallas for a taping of Glenn's television show. To reserve your seat, email tickets at glennbeck.com with your information. That's tickets at glennbeck.com. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program. 888-727-BECK.
Talking to the founder of Priceline.com and the founder of Upside.com, Jay Walker, who is with us. Let's talk a little bit about the future and what you're seeing in things like Priceline and Upside.
So one of the great futures is we're living in this digital world, right? And everybody's saying, look at all this data. Okay, what does that mean to me? What does that mean to a person sitting out in the audience and just listening? So, okay, that's nice. The world's filled with data. Here's what one of the things it means. It means your flexibility, which right now you don't get paid for, you're going to start getting paid for. Like when you're walking down the supermarket aisle and you see an item on sale next to one that isn't on sale, you can be flexible and say, I'm going to buy the brand that's on sale today because I normally buy that brand. But that's just a small case. What happens every time you're shopping online and somebody says, hey, are you willing to be a little flexible? I'll give you $50 if you do this instead of that. I'll give you $90 if you do this instead of that. Imagine a smart piece of software that offers you options that gives you personally more money for being flexible. And by the way, gives your boss something too. So the key idea behind one of the things I'm working on is how do you turn flexibility into an asset? How do you turn it into something where I have my phone? Hey, look, I want to go to New York on a trip, but if I leave 15 minutes earlier, you'll give me $50. If I leave an hour, if I go into a different airport, you'll give me $100. If I stay at a hotel across the street, that's worth $200 to me. I can't find all those choices. There's too many choices, but software can. The beauty of the world we're living in with this new big data software is it can evaluate tens of thousands of choices for you, show you just a few that make sense.
When we come back, can you talk a little bit about that? Because you've demonstrated that in Upside. And that's I got to that with you because I said, okay, what's the catch? And you explained it to me and I'm like, holy cow, that's brilliant. And you said to me, now imagine that with everything.
Because
that's the world. So let's talk about that. And also I want to talk about the world that is going out and examining all these things, but then putting us into little teeny boxes where we don't see the big picture anymore when we come back.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Jay Walker, the founder of Priceline.com, 900 patents to his name. Wired Magazine calls his library on imagination, he's an expert on imagination, the most amazing library in the world. He is a techno-optimist. He is also the guy who started the new travel website, Upside.com. Full disclosure, that is a sponsor. Yeah, that's how we met. However, the reason why he's here is not for that. It's for a conversation we had when he said, imagine... I said, what's the catch? How is this working? How is everybody making money here? Because you're reducing the time that the person spends from 80 minutes to about, what are you down to?
Five.
5 minutes to make the decision. You're booking the hotel, you're booking the flight, and you're
saving money.
Saving money for the company. Then you're giving an Amazon gift card.
Yeah.
And we've done things where it works out to where we've spent $200 with something that should have cost us $1,000 or would have cost us $1,000. It's like, in the end, it's like a $200 ticket and stay. That's insane. And I said to you, okay, what? When it's too good to be true,
absolutely.
It's too good to be true.
Ask extra questions.
Correct. Right. And you said, no, here's how it works. And imagine this with everything. Explain what that means.
Up to now, Americans have had a lot of choices, but unless they're super shoppers, they never see what their choices are worth. In complicated worlds like buying business travel or buying health insurance or buying medical care, there are millions of choices. You can't figure them all out. Software makes it possible for the first time to find choices that make sense for you.
So, but we're not in charge of our health care. So I've been saying, everyone should be, I want to give $5,000 a year. I'll cover the first $5,000. I'll buy catastrophic for everything else. Give me $5,000 a year. You go spend it. So when the doctor says, go get this x-ray, I can go get that x-ray here. But if I have a system that says, you know what, if you go tomorrow morning at this location, you're going to pay a fraction of
Glenn,
that.
One of the reasons why health care is so broken, one of the many reasons, but one of the big reasons is that the person paying for it isn't the person using it.
Yes.
And what happens when somebody else is paying for something and
care.
I get to use it? I overconsume. I give me the gold-plated everything. I mean, after all, I want every test. I want every treatment.
Correct.
So we right at the start, either the government's paying for it or my health insurer is paying for it or my boss is paying for it. When you have a system where a single decision by me could be costing $10,000 to somebody else, and by the way, not only am I not paying for it, the person selling it to me, the doctor or the hospital, they can't even tell me what the price is. You go in and ask the x-ray technician, how much is this x-ray? They have no idea. They don't know. So the seller doesn't know. The buyer doesn't know. Is it any doubt the system has completely run amok on cost?
So with what we have going on in Washington, you sound like this is the solution that I've been looking for. How are you going to get that when we're headed towards...
Well, it's not a solution. So, again, health and wellness is a system.
Yeah.
All right? It's not a binary A or B thing. If you treat your body like a garbage can, all right, you're going to get sick, no matter who pays for it.
Right.
Okay. So at the end of the day, this isn't a question of just making sure you're paying the right amount of money. You bet. We've got to make sure rational free market economics, which would work for everything well, work for healthcare. But there are plenty of people who can't afford health care. There are plenty of children whose parents make decisions for them. This isn't going to fix that problem. We have challenges in childhood obesity. It isn't going to fix that problem. We have an opioid epidemic. It isn't going to fix that. So market solutions are critically important, but they're important as part of a whole.
So how do you, let's stick to market here for a second. How do you correct a system and sell the free market system when the free market system hasn't really been practiced in this country for a very long time?
And not in healthcare, but
right. In many ways, in many things,
many industries,
it hasn't been practiced in a very long time. And people are taught that this is the free market system, and they see that it doesn't work, that it's awful and cumbersome, and they're being taught that, hey, this Marxism idea is a better idea. How do we tell the truth about the free market system to a group of people that really don't know and don't really care about what the free market system really is?
So the answer is, telling people who don't want to hear is probably not going to be our winning strategy.
Yes.
Okay?
Right.
It's just not going to be our winning strategy, right? Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to offer alternatives that exist against the dysfunctional system. And those alternatives will have to compete to attract people based on cost, efficacy, easiness, and those kind of things.
But this system
is probably going to do that. The mobile phone, when you add sensors and your ability to actually, within a few years, see what's going on inside your body, probably means we're going to have two systems. A public system that is going to be broken for a long time and we should try to improve, and a new technology that's going to emerge along the side where people, a significant number of people say, look, I just want better health for my children. And if this helps my kid, then I'm using this system. I don't care who's paying for it. People want their kids to be healthy. People want their parents to be healthy. A little less themselves, unfortunately.
You're a historian. You know that we've been around fake news forever. I mean, I have documents of fake news from the Revolutionary War.
It was perfectly normal for Thomas Jefferson to create fake news.
I mean, it happened.
Hardball those days.
I mean, your heads, you know, if you elect John Adams, your children's heads will be on a pike. I mean, hello.
There you go.
So we've had it forever. However, we are now in a system. You came up with the friend button at Facebook. Facebook is so freeing and gives people the power to connect with people like you and me, and people give people the power to have a voice just as powerful as anybody else's. But it also is, just because of the algorithms, making everyone's world smaller, and we're hearing the voices that we agree with and not necessarily the full spectrum. Then you add on top of that fake news. How are we going to manage this?
Well, first of all, let me set it straight. I'm not the inventor of the friend button. Some of the inventions I created led to it. So okay. I don't want to take credit for something I'm not the inventor.
Okay.
That being said, you're asking a tough question, and here's the question. The weather today is cold and rainy, but the climate is really what matters most here in Dallas, Texas, right? It might be cold and rainy today, but you're in Texas here. We have to remember that when we're hacking away at the weather, we're simply just hacking at the leaves. The climate is really the bigger issue. And let's talk about the climate. More people are getting more news from more sources than ever before. Yes, some of those sources are being constrained, but if you have confidence in people, you know what? You can fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all the time. We live in a world where the ability to control the news like Nazi Germany, or to control what any one person hears, is less than ever before. You know, old white men in New York City do not decide what's on the evening news anymore. We live in a much more information open society. Yes, within certain realms, it appears we're being constricted. We're having bracelets put around the news we see on Facebook. But that's not maybe what we're going to see on Twitter, or something new will emerge tomorrow.
Yeah.
Remember, the phone is going away, Glenn. The phone is an intermediate system. It's just an on-ramp to the network. It's almost certainly going to go to the glasses and probably with a little thing in your ear, assuming we don't direct connect to the brain. This is what's really going to happen. You're going to have way more opportunity to hear way more people. And these younger kids, they're way more global. Yeah, it's easy to fool some of the people some of the time, but overall, the climate is more open, more information. You know, I don't care whether you're the Chinese government or whether you're a dictator in Africa, or Korea, you're having a hard time controlling the flow of information.
When you look at the climate, some would call me jingoistic. I would not. I would call myself proud of the best system that has ever been created to help people explore. The minute you come up with a better system than our Constitution and the free market connecting moral sentiments to wealth of nations, I'm in. But this is the best that's been created. But we're now being taught that America, our children are being taught, America doesn't matter. It's a global community, and it is a global community. But how do we balance a global community with these principles are global and eternal?
Well, there you've got the core of the problem. We used to have much more of a common culture. We used to have much more of a common heritage. We used to see talk about Western values and Western civilization as an absolute good in the larger scheme of history, and we don't do that any longer.
Is it an absolute source of good in the overall picture? Well,
if you study history, there is no systems other than ours that have lifted more people out of poverty, that have given more opportunity to more people who never had opportunity. If you're a woman, you want to be an American. If you're an African American, you want to be an American. If you want to, half the world would like to come to America. I'm not arguing that we're perfect or even better in every way. But what I'm saying is market-based systems with real competition and checks and balances that in a government that works has been by far and away the best system. There isn't even anybody in second place, right? There are just fakes. So at the end of the day, when China wanted to lift hundreds of millions of people out of desperate poverty, they turned to capitalism to do it. Yeah, they put a Chinese brand on it, but baby, they unlocked initiative, they unlocked risk-taking, they unlocked imagination at the market level, they opened their borders to global supply. They basically adopted the Western system, they just called it the Chinese Communist Party.
A friend of mine went over and talked to the Chinese, this is 2008, and he was very concerned about us. And Chinese said, you guys might be kicked down and you might have some time where you're kicked down for a while. But you have something that the world doesn't have, and that is imagination.
Permission to fail. The big difference in America is in the rest of the world, when you're a failure, you're dead. You're done. In America, when you're a failure, you're Bill Gates. You're Steve Jobs. You're a failure? Perfect. You've dropped out of school? Perfect. We love you. Okay. America is a country that reinvents itself and has always done so. We believe in the individual. We believe in responsibility. Look, we're the most charitable nation by far in the world. Just look at the nature of charity in America. Only people of generosity and wealth can be charitable. Most of the world doesn't do it. It makes no sense in China to donate money to a hospital. There are no hospitals in China paid for by wealthy Chinese. This doesn't work that way. America does that, and it's because we have permission to try, to fail, to try again. We literally, from the very start in our patent system, said, if you can invent something, you don't have to practice it, and you don't have to be rich to get a patent.
I think one of the worst things that we've done are the bailouts and everything else, and a lot of people will say, because it's not our position as government, but my core on that is, I have a right to fail. As much as I have a right to succeed, my failures are more important to me than my successes. I am who I am today because of massive failures in my life.
All great hitters strike out a lot. Okay? They swing at the ball and they strike out. The poor hitters watch the ball go by. Right? The great hitters put it in play and they're out. But that's no different than all of us. The fact of the matter is, America allows for that. Now, sure, we have bailouts. Why? Because we have a political democracy, and you put enough people out of work, that's a lot of votes going out of work. And so there's enormous pressure to not let those enterprises fail. But we've learned over and over again, even when the largest enterprises in our country have failed over their history or have become irrelevant in their over their arc of history, the country bounces back. It finds new ways to deploy resources. It motivates people to learn. In America, everybody wants to be wealthy. They don't want to drag the wealthy down. They want to join the wealthy. That's why America lives the way it lives.
Jay Walker is our guest, an inventor described as a serial entrepreneur, founder of Priceline, founder of Upside.com, an imagination expert, has the library of the history of human imagination, a techno-optimist. And we only have about 2 minutes left. On the other side, I want to come back. I want to ask you, if you're an entrepreneur and you are out there swinging for the fences today, what is the one thing, one piece of advice that you would give them to say, just focus here? Or have you asked yourself this? We'll do that when we come back.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Jay Walker, the founder of Priceline and Upside.com. Tell me, if you're an entrepreneur and you're out there struggling, give me a piece of advice.
There's only one person that matters, assuming you've got the oxygen you need, right? The oxygen is the capital you need to do anything. But if you've got the oxygen, it's all about the customer. People are continuously reinventing how to serve customers. If you serve the customer, you win the game. There are endless ways to serve customers that have never been possible before. And that's what this new technology revolution is doing. It's putting things up in the air that have never been up in the air, that you can actually find customers and serve them. That's the key, serve the customer.
Upside.com, Jay Walker, great to have you. We'll be on Facebook later today. Don't miss it.
Thank you.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.